was one of those things where you discuss it with your creative director and you say to yourself, no, this can't be done. It's overt. It's been done. You know, the look of Liza Minnelli with the makeup and the hair, it's done today. It's one of the quintessential Vidal Sassoon looks. And it was great when you tell fashion houses when you're doing pulls that you are styling this kind of a shoot, because a film that poignant, a film that important, they will know. And they, I think they just really are tickled at the idea of participating in like a recreation of it.
Former fashion editor for Black Book magazine, Brian Lewandowski, will browse some of the world's most stylish films soon. From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, also ahead.
We like to call Belgrade open air studio because you can just go around the corner and find Paris or find some small cities. So everything is available here.
Why make a film in Serbia? We'll visit one of the country's leading production facilities to find out why location scouts ought to be keeping an eye on the European nation. Plus,
he realized he had to do this movie when he saw himself made up as a woman. They showed him how he'd look on screen. And he was shocked that he wasn't pretty. And he was shocked further to realize that if he saw this person, this reflection at a party, he wouldn't bother talking to her. And he just suddenly thought, oh, it's much harder for women.
Author Hadley Freeman recalls the surprising reason why Dustin Hoffman took on the role of Tootsie in this week's Critics' Choice. That's all to come on The Cinema Show, right here on Monocle 24. From Midori House in London, welcome to The Cinema Show with me, Ben Rylan. I'm joined today by Brian Lewandowski. He is the former fashion editor of Black Book magazine and just happens to be one of the biggest devotees to one of the films we'll be looking at today. Brian, welcome to The Cinema Show.
Thanks.
Clearly, movies can often act as time capsules for how people dressed decades ago and looked decades ago. I'm thinking of the television series Mad Men using the style of Grace Kelly as the template for Betty Draper. But it really goes both ways, doesn't it? Fashion influences film and films influence fashion, of course, don't they?
Absolutely. Films don't really age in that respect, that you can have films that were even made sort of obscurely back in the day, small indie films that become cult classics, you know, 30, 40, 50 years down the line, and you find them referenced today.
Have you ever, when you've been trying to maybe decide on an outfit for yourself, I suppose this could be described as taking your work home with you, but have you ever thought about people that you've seen in films? Do they venture into your head sometimes and maybe you subconsciously find yourself trying to replicate a look that you've seen on the screen?
Actually, I have many a time, especially when getting dressed up for something formal, and you wear something as simple as a tux, I have seriously felt myself channeling Marcello Mastroianni in a bunch of Fellini films, especially in Eight and a Half. Just, he's so elegant in the way he does it. Or something like Blow Up, where it was like the fashion suit, where it was, you know, cut so slim. And even today, you see that. And even before it was, you know, back in style officially, you had groups like The Strokes kind of just doing that thing on their own, and it's just so great how it's repeated, it's influenced, it's so, so relevant.
Well, we'll talk about the style in one of Brian's many obsessions soon, that being the classic 1972 film Cabaret. But first, let's take a look at some of the most influential forces behind fashion in the cinema.
You know, of course, that diamonds are a girl's best friend, and this is our proof of it.
Perhaps no one demonstrated more classic looks on the screen than Marilyn Monroe. The superb 1953 romantic comedy How to Marry a Millionaire even sees her and her co-stars Lauren Bacall and Betty Grable taking part in a lengthy fashion show. They were the designs of William Travilla, professionally known as simply Travilla. He dressed Marilyn in 8 of her films and was nominated for an Oscar for his work in this film. He's often remembered as the man who draped Marilyn in a fringed Idaho potato sack in an effort to prove that she looked good no matter what she wore.
Oh, do you feel the breeze from the subway? Isn't it delicious?
Fashion influences films in profound ways. Sometimes, however, it goes even further and inspires the first seeds of an idea. Such was the case for Italy's Federico Fellini.
Hello. Trevilla, where are you?
Rome's Trevi founder never looked more peaceful than when an enchanting Anita Ekberg wandered in for a night swim dressed in a black Balenciaga dress. The 1957 design is said to have inspired Fellini's vision for his 1960 classic film. That was also the year that Alfred Hitchcock started making movies for Universal Pictures. He wouldn't work with his regular collaborator Edith Head again until 1969's Topaz, but her work in his films had already helped establish the look of Hitchcock's entry into Hollywood filmmaking, peaking with 1958's Vertigo.
Well,
I should be back from your face and pinned at the neck. I told her that. I told you that.
We tried it. It just didn't seem to suit me.
The simple grey suit worn by Kim Novak seemed only a slight alteration from Edith Head's earlier work for Doris Day in The Man Who Knew Too Much 2 years earlier. Far more than mere set dressing, the look of Novak's character here was crucial to the plot and to the film's eventual place as the American Film Institute's pick for the greatest movie of all time. Gender norms often meant that the real opportunities for fashion creatives only came when they were dressing women, especially in the 1950s and 60s. But that started to change when James Dean and Marlon Brando took over the screen, especially with 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire. The basic t-shirt actually descends from the underwear worn by men in the Navy back in the 1910s. It was Chanel who started using the jersey fabric for women's wear in the 1920s, which is around the time that t-shirt entered the American English Dictionary. Levi recently introduced a reissue of Brando's tee, off-white in colour with a slim body and a pocket. The original would no doubt fetch a fortune at fashion auctions if Brando hadn't torn it to shreds.
Hey, Stella!
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Brian Lewandowski is still with me. Brian, it is time. We need to talk about Cabaret.
Money.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around, the clinking, clanking sound.
Now, much of the style that we associate with cabaret doesn't exactly lend itself to what you might term everyday attire, but it still had its impact on the fashion world, the real world of fashion, of course, hasn't it?
It has. I think sort of just owing to the outrageous wardrobe done in the show, I think it's all sort of summed up, you know, in the first few minutes when Ryan Roberts arrives at the flat and Sally Bowles sort of flashes her green nails and she's like, divine decadence. And that really, it sets the stage for everything. I mean, it's such a heavy phrase because, yes, it's for the film and the genre and, you know, the sort of the historical background. But, yes, for the outfits, for the louche way she throws around a fur coat, like, it really sets the stage in such an elegant, beautifully subtle way.
The character of Sally Bowles obviously speaks to that quite a bit too, but the decadence has a lot to do with the look and feel of the film and the legacy it's had, purely in a visual sense as well, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And it was one of those interesting parts as a child watching it, and I say child, I probably saw it for the first time when I was 8 on, I guess it was AMC, American Movie Classics, and I was getting into musicals then, but Cabaret as a film, it's sort of, I think it transcends the musical because most of the music is within the, you know, the confines of the Kit Kat Club, so you don't get the sense that it is this, you know, big humdinger on a stage. And so
that is quite different to the stage version, though, isn't it? Because from what I understand, I've never seen it on the stage, but on stage, the music furthers the plot and takes place sort of like in the traditional sense of a musical. It's kind of this other form of reality where the music is just happening. Whereas in the movie, as you say, it's all taking place within the club, so it's, you're not suspending your disbelief to watch them perform the music.
Exactly. And then you get a sense of sort of the social climb, the political climb. There's this interesting evolution that happens throughout the film, in the beginning especially, when you see a Nazi get kicked out of the Kit Kat Club, and then toward the end you see another scene and it's sort of dominated by them. And so there's that visual. I remember as a kid as well, seeing the swastika for the first time just sort of displayed, and it was just very stark. It was like thrilling and frightening, and you don't see this, you know, growing up, and it was part of this film, and it I don't know, this chilling moment sort of happened then. But then it sort of goes into the rest of the film, and you see this fashion, you see this lascivious behavior and this amazing, you know, superfluousness and phones at tables. And it just really opens up into this like divine decadence. And whether or not you're familiar with it, you feel part of it. It's really, really immersive.
And that obviously had an effect on you early on, because years later when you were fashion editor of Black Book, one of the shoots that you were coordinating, that you were styling, took all of its inspiration from Cabaret.
Yes. It was one of those things where you discuss with your creative director and you say to yourself, no, this can't be done. It's overt. It's been done. You know, the look of Liza Minnelli with the makeup and the hair, it's done today. It's almost like sort of this, you know, one of the quintessential Vidal Sassoon looks. So you just get this wonderful idea and it becomes this pipe dream for a while. And then you sort of discuss ways of making it happen. And you say, yes, we're going to do this and we're going to be brazen. And if someone doesn't like it, oh well. But it became extremely successful. It was fun to do. It was extremely fun. And it was great when you tell fashion houses when you're doing pulls that you are styling this kind of a shoot, because a film that poignant, a film that important, they will know. And I think they just really are tickled at the idea of sort of participating in like a recreation of it.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
The late and great Natasha Richardson there as Sally Bowles, performing on Broadway way back in 1998. The film version of Cabaret is screening this Saturday, the 6th of August, at the Regent Street Cinema here in London as part of a double bill with Vincent Minnelli's classic Gigi. This is The Cinema Show. We'll head to Serbia next.
If you like good movies, well, you're in luck. The good people at MUBI have lined up an amazing menu of films just waiting to be devoured. Among the titles streaming right now, you'll find a special focus on director Kelly Reichardt, including Wendy and Lucy, Old Joy, Meek's Cut Off, and an online exclusive, her acclaimed debut feature, River of Grass.
If you ever mistakenly got on the Palmetto Expressway and headed west, you'd run right into the Florida Everglades, an area that Indians like to call the River of Grass.
Head to MUBI.com/monocle for a whole month of movies for free. That's MUBI/monocle.
Report Card, brought to you by The Cinema Show.
$50 million, that's the reported budget of a new movie adaptation of the classic Broadway musical Gypsy. Barbara Streisand is attached to the project, but this week, would-be distributor and co-financier STX Entertainment pulled out. Gypsy was first put on screen by director Mervyn LeRoy back in 1962, in a musical starring Natalie Wood and Rosalind Russell, though Russell's voice wasn't quite up to the demands of Mama Rose, and many of her vocals had to be dubbed. Given the recent success of the West End production starring Imelda Staunton, another shot at screen success is inevitable. That's how many people were arrested during the Detroit riots in 1967. Oscar-winning director Catherine Bigelow is developing a new film based upon the mass outbreak of civil unrest that stemmed from Detroit's catastrophic economic downfall. Throughout the 1960s, the city lost about 156,000 residents. Racial tensions were a major force driving the riots, with nearly 16% of African Americans facing unemployment in the 1950s, compared to just 6% of the city's white population.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll.
63 seats, that's the capacity of the small upstairs space at the Royal Court Theatre here in London, where on the 19th of June 1973, the Rocky Horror Show held its first performance. The 1975 film version starring Tim Curry is perhaps best known cult classic of all time. A new two-hour remake stars Laverne Cox as Dr. Frank N. Furter, with Tim Curry back, this time as the narrator. It will premiere at the MIPCOM conference in Cannes this October before a special screening on America's Fox network.
You're back with The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. It might be stretching it to call Yugoslavia the Hollywood of Southeast Europe, but it really did have a sizable film industry, not just making films for domestic consumption, but international co-productions too, which were delighted to take advantage of the sizable studio facilities, skilled crew, and stunning locations. Much of that was lost during and after the breakup of Yugoslavia. The best-known studio complex, Avala Film in Belgrade, is only just getting back on its feet. But Serbia's film industry is once more on an upward curve, thanks to new, modern studios, tax breaks for international productions, and the ongoing tradition of skilled crew. Our correspondent there, Guy Delaunay, went to see the best of the new wave of Serbian cinema.
The set builders are working hard at PFI Studios on the outskirts of Belgrade. After a couple of decades in the doldrums, international film productions are once again coming to Serbia. And this complex is one of the main reasons. It opened at the start of the decade with the needs of modern filmmakers in mind.
When they start to build the big stages here, I was involved in this. They work in the United States, they work in Canada, they work in Russia, Germany, everywhere, you know. And I know in Cinecittà studio in Italy and so on. And I know those kind of size of the studio. And I know where is sometimes was the problem and what is the good and what is the bad thing. And I pick up all the good things, you know, just to create those studios. And I think those size of studio really now in the moment are the best in Europe.
Miljan Kljakovic knows his stuff. He's better known in the film industry as Kreka, a production designer par excellence. He won Caesar and Felix Awards for his work on the surreal French film Delicatessen and has also been up for Emmys. Kreka has recreated Venice in Luxembourg and Mecca in Iran. But now he's back in Serbia and full of optimism for the future.
Now it's start, you know. It's some kind of let's say, you know, that the people coming here to shoot the movie because, first of all, it's cheaper. We had, actually, big, very good base to making the movie here. A lot of people, you know, who are in the movie, and it's a very, very good movie makers. And the young generation will have some, get some more experience because the biggest experience you can get on the big movies, you know.
Do you offer them the benefit of your experience?
Absolutely. I was professor on university sometimes, you know, and just a guest in university and other university. And of course, that now I'm in the 65 years old, you know, and it's my career going down, you know, because it's young generation is coming. You know, of course, there is, you know, I like to, you know, transform and to give them my experience, you know, just to explain them how it's working on the big movies and the big sets and so on and so on.
So we're in Soundstage 6. As I mentioned, Soundstages 4, 5, and 6 are all the same size. They're 1,280 square meters.
PFI's executive director, Barbara Sandick, is happy to show off the studio's bang-up-to-date facilities.
They have full grids. We call them grids. They're actually catwalks, which are on below the roof, and they can be used for stunt work.
There are already 8 soundstages here at PFI Studios, and plans for one more, the biggest of the lot, complete with a water tank for sub-aqua scenes. The films shot here since it opened range from period drama, John Cusack in The Raven, to science fiction, Luc Besson's Lockout, with Guy Pearce leading the cast on a totally green set. But Barbara says it's the capabilities of the local crew which are the key to bringing in productions.
Not only do we have the tradition, we have the film crews. Some of them are older, but they could transfer their experience and their knowledge to younger generations. A lot of these film crews or heads of departments for production design, costume, prop design, and so forth are professors at the universities, the film schools here, so they've trained the younger generations. So there's been a tradition. So there's good quality crews at, I wouldn't say cheaper prices, but very good quality for very competitive prices. There's kind of that balance.
The delayed revival of Belgrade's film facilities has also proved a blessing in disguise, offering the opportunity to start again from a blank slate with a cutting-edge offering.
We do have a jump on the competition. Our competition are basically studios in the region. So if we look at older studios, there's Barrandov in Czech Republic in Prague. They have a new stage, the 007 stage, which they built to bring back the franchise. But most of the other stages are old. So yes, they've upgraded them and so forth, but there's only so much you can do to an older facility. When we decided to build, there was basically only Castel in Bucharest was the new stage in the region, and they slowly started building.
But there's more than studios to this story. International crews are a common sight on Belgrade's streets. Milica Božanić from the Serbia Film Commission says the capital itself is a major draw as a shooting location.
We like to call Belgrade open-air studio because you can just go around the corner and find Paris or find some small cities. So everything is available here, from Mediterranean looks to more Central Europe, Western Europe. But you can also sometimes double some location, such as Russian tundras or faraway natural beauties that are not in the city, but really just an hour or two drive from the city of Belgrade.
Tax breaks are the other big deal. Costs in Serbia were already considerably lower than most other European countries. Now, after years of lobbying, the government has introduced a 20% rebate for international productions shooting here.
Incentives would make a really huge difference and really huge impact. What we would like to do is to have a balanced ratio in between the international big production, but also some smaller co-productions. There should be also a huge development in the local content and production of local films, keeping the incentives going and making them really effective, well-processed, and well-known and well-established in the world would be our primarily goal. For now.
Just going to let the background go a little bit on this one, guys. So, background action.
The action is underway, but Serbia still has a long way to go before it truly reclaims the glory days. And it now has to deal with a massive and well-established competitor 3 hours up the motorway in Budapest. But movie makers love a sequel, and it's fair to say that Serbia's resurgent film industry is at least a force that's awakening. For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Thanks, Guy. Now, finally today, in the words of one Mr. Ferris Bueller, life moves pretty fast. It's also a phrase adopted by the author and journalist Hadley Freeman in her book chronicling her love for movies of the 1980s. From Steel Magnolias to The Princess Bride, it's easy to forget just how far we've come since the days when major motion pictures revolved around people without superhuman abilities. Hadley will be back on the show next week to guide us through her love for cinema of the 1980s, but for this week's Critics' Choice, we asked her to take us back to 1982 and explain why Tootsie is still a perfect movie. Well, almost.
I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They went a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic!
It works so perfectly because it has a perfect performance from Dustin Hoffman, and it is just so funny. I could just read the script. I have a copy of the script at home, and I read it, and I just laugh out loud. But Dustin Hoffman approached that character so sympathetically. He doesn't play the cross-dressing for laughs. And he gave an interview a few years ago in which he said that he realized he had to do this movie when he saw himself made up as a woman. They showed him how he'd look on screen. And he was shocked that he wasn't pretty. And he was shocked further to realize that if he saw this person, this reflection at a party, he wouldn't bother talking to her. And he just suddenly thought, oh, it's much harder for women. And I think men don't realize that, and why should they? I mean, empathy would be nice, but, you know, I understand why a lot of men don't realize that. And he thought, I want to play this woman. I want to show a woman who is not classically beautiful, plain is how they make her up in the movie, who is interesting, and what she can achieve within those limits, really.
And he does. And I think it's wonderful. I wish the movie didn't end with him getting together with Jessica Lange. I wish he got together with Terry Garr. But I also understand why they had to do it.
You know, I can remember years ago, there was none of this talk about what a woman was, what a man was. You just were what you were. Mm-hmm. And now they have all this stuff about how much you should be like the other sex, so you can be all more the same. And I'm sorry, but we're just not, you know?
Right.
Not on a farm, anyway. Bulls are bulls, and roosters don't try to lay eggs.
I think people weren't so sure if that movie was going to succeed, to be honest. I mean, you could see there's, in some cases, they're a little bit nervous. It's not that 80s movies audiences were so much more sophisticated. I think, you know, if Tootsie came out today, it would be a massive success. If When Harry Met Sally came out today, it would be a massive success. It's that studios underestimate audiences now because there's also more at stake, that it costs so much money to release movies now that they just play to the lowest common denominator. So they want a movie that's going to make all the teenage boys and men go see it. So, you know, Suicide Squad or whatever. They just would not bother with Tootsie. They would just freak out. This idea of a cross-dressing man in a soap opera. I mean, what the hell is this? When Tootsie's on TV, which it is on quite often, it's still funny. And I still look on Twitter and I see everyone going, "Ooh, Tootsie's on, you know, film 4 or whatever." There are plenty of movies from the 80s that do not hold up. Like, Mannequin definitely does not hold up. It is a terrible, terrible movie. Loads of the movies that I loved as a kid, so things like Meatballs, which is Bill Murray as a camp counselor, which is so stupid. Stripes is so stupid. That's Bill Murray with Harold Ramis. The big hits from the 80s, things like Porky's, definitely don't hold up. You know, I memorized all the Police Academy films when I was a kid, and I can tell you they don't hold up. But the good ones so hold up, and what's amazing is how many good ones there are. You know, Ferris, Tootsie, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Ghostbusters. And I honestly don't think, like, nostalgia aside, I just cannot imagine there are going to be that many movies that hold up from our decade in 30 years' time.
Hadley Freeman there, author of Life Moves Pretty Fast, The Lessons We Learned from 80s Movies, published by Fourth Estate. And movie subscribers here in the United Kingdom can catch Tootsie. It's streaming right now. And that's it for today. We're off to the Melbourne International Film Festival next week. We'll also look at the re-release of Studio Ghibli's 1991 film Only Yesterday. And of course, Hadley Freeman returns to discuss, among other things, why the romantic comedy has fallen out of fashion, tragic, and which film officially killed the genre. Today's show was edited by Claire Crofton and researched by Yolene Goffin. Listen again and find out more over at our website, monocle.com, and subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave us a review. It helps others find the show. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.